Bobby told me last week that he wouldn't be here this week. And then, in the same breath, he told me that he'd known that for about a month. So I smiled real nice. And I nodded my head and I said, "It's okay, Bobby." And at the same time, I was thinking about bombs and things like that. But I was nice. I didn't say anything like that.
So. He knew what you were thinking.
Huh?
He knew what you were thinking.
Well, if he did, he didn't indicate it. But I was thinking, you know, Bobby, I've got bombs. But I didn't say anything. Oh, yeah. He'd probably come and look me up. Anyway, we're in the book of Galatians. And we were in chapter 4. Verse 9, we were wrapping that up. So if you want to be turning with me to Galatians, we'll wrap up verse 9 and then move on. In verse 9, Galatians 4, "But now after that ye have known God, or rather are known of God, how turn ye again to the weak and beggarly elements, whereunto you desire again to be in bondage?" And we talked about the importance of knowing God, and we talked about the importance of being known by God last week. And we were starting to get into the last part of this verse. "How turn ye again to the weak and beggarly elements whereunto you desire to be in bondage?" And I'm reading out of the King James Version this morning. And one of the things that we really need to take from this, we were just about done with it, but one of the things that we need to take from this is that all along, throughout this whole letter, Paul has been contrasting the law of Moses with the faith of Christ, or the law of Christ, the gospel. And he acknowledged earlier on that there were other faith systems that some of the Galatians were under at the time. Just kind of touched on it. So what we need to take from this, and it's very important, is that by what Paul said here, "Why turn ye again to the weak and beggarly elements?" What he has done is, in effect, he has lowered the law of Moses to an equal standing with the natural laws of the Gentiles that they live under. And that is too significant to overlook. What Paul is saying here, by inference, he didn't just come right out and say it, but he implied it in what he said, is that the law of Moses is now no better than any of the other ones that they live under. Why do you want to turn again to the weak and beggarly elements? He is referring to the law of Moses and whatever natural laws that the Gentiles might have been living under. He lumped them both up in the same category. They're worthless. Why, after you have known the faith of Christ, why, after you come to Christ, would you go back to one of those systems? You know, and he wants to know that. He's asking him, why would you do that? What are you thinking? In effect, is what he's saying. What are you thinking? So we'll move in, with that in mind, we'll move into verse 10. Galatians 4:10. "Ye observe days and months and seasons and years." Now, for those of you that have been here all along, I've been saying that Paul is binding them to, the Judaizers are binding them to much more than just circumcision. And here is the verse that proves that. "Ye observe days and months and seasons and years." And what we need to understand and take from this is that they're already doing it. They're already observing. This is a reference to Jewish holy days. Earlier in this studies, when we observed that the Judaizers were trying to bind more than the law of Moses on the circumcision, we looked at this. And here is the proof within the letter itself. I had referenced another verse in Acts. I don't remember what it was, but it says that they were trying to bring them under the law of Moses. But here it is in Galatians 4:10 in the very letter. Here is the, and these Judaizers were teaching them to keep the Jewish religious holy days, months, seasons, and years that are in the law of Moses. These could have included, but were not necessarily limited to, the Sabbath day. And we don't know exactly which ones that they were. But it could be the Sabbath day, the feast days, such as Passover, Pentecost, perhaps the feast of the new moon, the feast of the weeks, the feast of the trumpets, the feast of the end gathering, and numerous other special Jewish religious occasions, such as the year of the Jubilee. The Judaizers did not stop with just circumcision. And that's kind of consistent with what we know about some of the Pharisees and the Judaizers that were operating behind the scenes. Go ahead, C.L.
Yeah, back up here in verse 9, where it says enslaved all over again, which the law is what would enslave.
Right.
In 1 Corinthians 7, starting verse 18 down through 23.
1 Corinthians 7.
Let him not become uncircumcised. Has anybody been called uncircumcised? Let him not be circumcised. Circumcision is nothing. Uncircumcision is nothing. But what matters is keeping the commandments of God. That each man remain in the condition which he was called. Were you called while a slave? Do not worry about it. But if you are able to become free, rather do that. For he who was called in the Lord while a slave is the Lord's free man. Likewise, he who was called while free is Christ's slave. You were bought with a price. Do not become slaves of men. And the old law makes you slaves of men.
Right. Absolutely right. And that's what Paul's been saying along. Are you reading out of the New American Standard Bible?
Yeah, it's New American Standard.
Yeah, I love that translation. That's a great one. Thought I recognized that.
Trying to find one of them. There's people that said that it's all wrong because it changes some of the meaning and basically their best.
Well, we're going to hear in our sermon today a word that the New American Standard Bible translates perfectly, that the other ones don't. And that's part of our sermon this morning. But anyway, I thought I recognized that. And yes, that's true. Whenever we go back under, whenever the Judaizers convinced the Galatians to go back under the old law, any part of it, and we're really going to touch on that later in chapter 5 when we get into it. They're bringing them back under the bondage of the old law, which we have discussed over and over again, and which Paul has said over and over again, that the old law was completely unable to justify anybody. And it's not just the letter of Galatians where Paul gets into this, as C.L. wrote. He touches on it in Romans, and he touches on it in Ephesians. And he really gets into it in Galatians and in Corinthians. He really talks about this, and that makes, and if you'll think about that, that's real consistent with what we know of the Judaizers. They weren't just working in Galatia. They were working all over the place. When the great persecution, after Stephen was stoned and the great persecution started and the Christians dispersed all over the known realm, more than just the Christians left. The Judaizers, the Pharisees, a lot of them were displaced, and they moved all over the realm. And they were following behind the Christians in a lot of these churches doing the same thing. Galatians is just a letter that Paul wrote to a bunch of churches where the Judaizers had been particularly successful. As we learn in this, when he says you observe all these Jewish feasts and related holy days and things like that, notice he said years. This had been going on for a while.
Well, but too, also there are certain years that there are certain things that the Jews adhere to. You know,
right.
Every year, but it's on a certain number.
They've got the year of the Jubilee. That's right. Isn't that the Jubilee, or is that the...
I don't remember.
I forget how all of that works.
My mother gave me a list one time about all the different sacrifices and the things of different years, and I cannot find it.
I wish I had it.
But I cannot find it. I don't know where I put it, and I can't find it.
That would be quite a job to go back through the Old Testament and the Torah.
It was a printed thing, and I don't know
I would like to have it too. Galatians 4:10. Let's get back on our lesson here. Thank you, CL, for bringing that up, by the way. It should be noted here that Galatia was not the only place where the Judaizers were at work. Paul made a reference to this in Colossians 2:16 through 18, where he wrote, "So let no one judge you in food or in drink or regarding a festival or a new moon or Sabbaths, which are a shadow of things to come. But the substance is of Christ. Let no one cheat you of your reward, taking delight in false humility and worship of angels, intruding into those things which he had not seen, vainly puffed up by his fleshly mind." The keeping of the Sabbath day was an exclusive element of the law of Moses. So when we see a reference to that, it is a reference to those who would bind the law on others. And there are several references to that in Paul's writings in all of his epistles. Paul was instructing his readership in Colossae to disregard the teachings of those who would judge them for not observing holy days under the law of Moses. Within this was included an unmistakable warning about losing their reward. And Paul tells them that in Galatians, and just as plain a language as it can get in Galatians 5, and we're going to get to that later on in our study. But that unmistakable warning about losing their reward. What the Judaizers were doing had the result of costing these people their salvation. It's a big deal. Big deal. That's why Paul is so impassioned in his letter. That's why he fought against that, why he opposed that in so many of his epistles that he wrote that we have in the New Testament. Galatians 4:11, "I am afraid of you, lest by any means I have bestowed labor upon you in vain." Paul has made several references to the consequences for allowing the Judaizers to influence them, and this is another one. Each time he mentions this, the point seems to get a little stronger. Here, Paul expresses fear for their souls and concerns that he had exposed them to the teachings of the gospel for nothing. The labor he mentions here is the work required by all Christians, which is benevolence, that we read of in Matthew 25:31 through 46, evangelism. Matthew 28:18 through 20, that's what we know as the Great Commission, and edification, Romans 15:1 through 2. That is the work of Christians, all summed up in three verses. Paul is concerned that because they had submitted to the doctrine of the Judaizers, that the work of a Christian that he had committed to them and that they had been doing was for nothing. It's vain, and that they would all be lost anyway. And that is the consequences of our labor being in vain. If it's for nothing, if what we do as Christians is for nothing, and what the Galatian Christians did was for nothing, there's really no other conclusion that you can draw from that. If it's all in vain, then we're and they are lost. It's for nothing. We might as well have not bothered ourselves to even become a Christian in the first place. They were no better off now than when they were before Paul arrived, because they had accepted what the Judaizers were teaching. They'd accepted it. The King James Version and the American Standard Version render this verse as "bestowed labor upon you." Most of the other English translations render this verse as Paul saying he had labored for them in vain. Now this is interesting. I looked this up. The actual order of the words in the original language is, "I am afraid of you, lest in vain I have bestowed labor upon you." That is the exact order of the words in the Greek language. I'm going to read that again. "I am afraid of you, lest in vain I have bestowed labor upon you." Many modern translations appear to go out of their way at any opportunity to shift the language away from there being any commitment for a Christian to work. And this is one of them. In either event, it makes no difference whether it was Paul's labor or the Galatian Christians' labor, which was wasted. The end results are the same. If Paul's labor was for nothing, the Galatians became Christians for nothing. Likewise, if the Galatian Christians' labor was for nothing, they became Christians for nothing. The consequences under both translations or both renderings of the original language are the same, which is loss of salvation and eternal condemnation from the presence of God. CL, which way does your New American Standard Bible translate that?
Which one?
Verse 11. That I have labored over you in vain. Some of the more modern translations kind of shift the labor from being Paul bestowing it upon them. Rather, it's saying that Paul's labor, that Paul said his labor over them was vain. It's kind of shifting, and some of the, and different translations translate that in two different ways. Go ahead, CL. Yeah. Some of the other translations that I read translate it as, let's see, I use the American Standard Version for this study. I am afraid of you, lest by means I have bestowed labor upon you in vain. So some of the translations make it look like Paul was the one that was bestowing the labor, and some of them make it look like the labor was bestowed, that Paul was doing the labor. And some of the translations make it look like Paul was bestowing the labor upon them in vain. What the point we need to take from that is the results are the same. Do what? I didn't hear you.
Was I teaching you in vain? Or did
yeah.
I taught you in vain? I mean, that's what his labor is. When he imparted the word of God to him, that was his labor, and he, you know, the fruit of the labor when he became Christian.
Right. In either event, whichever translation is right, the end results of what the Galatians have done are the same. It's the same. Which way you translate that doesn't make any difference in the outcome. Is what I'm trying to get across here. As I looked through all the different translations as I was studying this, I noticed that some of them had two different ways that it was translated. And I don't know which one that everybody here particularly likes to follow. So I'm trying to cover all the bases here. The end results are the same. If Paul's labor was vain, if Paul's labor for them was vain, then they became Christians for nothing. If Paul bestowed the labor on them in vain, and the labor was their responsibility, then the result, and it was vain, then the results are still the same. Nothing has changed in the end results. Anyway, moving into verse 12. I beseech ye, brethren, become as I am, for I also am become as ye are. Excuse me. Lots of dust yesterday. You did me no wrong. I beseech ye, brethren, become as I am, for I also am become as ye are. Ye did me no wrong. And again, I'm reading out of the American Standard Version. This is an expression of a painfully agitated, loving, and affectionate heart. The word beseech in the original language carries the meaning of to plead or to beg. Paul is genuinely afraid for their spiritual well-being. Paul's state of mind here as he writes this is one of agony and great anxiety over the souls of his Galatian brethren. He says, become as I am. Paul had abandoned the law of Moses completely, along with all the Jewish rites and customs. He is begging them to do the same thing. Become as I am. We must acknowledge and bear in mind Paul's emotional state while writing this. He is agonizing over them, begging with them, pleading them to abandon these things just as he had. Remember, Paul was a Pharisee. He was persecuting Christians. He was instrumental in the deaths of many Christians before his conversion, before Jesus Christ appeared to him on the road to Damascus. Paul did a whole bunch of changing real fast. And he wants them to become as he had. Their eternal well-being is hanging in the balance, and that's why Paul is begging them, beseeching them. He goes on to say, "For I also am become as ye are." To the degree possible, Paul had also abandoned some of his own customs and practices in order to reach them, to save them. In other words, Paul assimilated himself into their culture, going so far as to adopt some of their customs or behavioral mannerisms in order for them to be comfortable with each other. This is not the only time that Paul has made mention of this practice of his. He did this as on a regular basis. If you want to turn with me to 1 Corinthians 9, we'll look at another time whenever Paul did this. 1 Corinthians chapter 9, starting in verse 19. And this will shed a little bit of light on what Paul means here as becoming as they are. And this is reading out of the New King James Version. "For though I am free from all men," and this is verse 19 of chapter 9 of 1 Corinthians. "For though I am free from all men, I have made myself a servant to all, that I might win the more. And to the Jews I became as a Jew, that I might win Jews. To those who are under the law, as under the law, that I might win those who are under the law. To those who are without law, as without law, not being without law towards God, but under law towards Christ, that I might win those who are without law. To the weak I became as weak, that I might win the weak. I have become all things to all men, that I might by all means save some." Paul would go to great lengths to preach the gospel, even so far as observing their customs and practices, which obviously did not transgress the will of God. And we'll talk about that here in just a minute. It would be an abuse of this text to try and say that Paul routinely did what he was condemning in his letter to the Galatian Christians in order to gain an audience with them in hopes of teaching them the truth later on. And I have seen this in some of the stuff that I have encountered. What Paul was saying to his readership here is that he tried to become like them to the degree possible, that they were comfortable with one another in order to facilitate the spreading of the gospel. I have seen this verse and the one in Galatians used to say, to teach and promote the idea that Paul actually participated in some of the Jewish rituals with other people that he was trying to convert. I don't think that's true at all. Why in the world would Paul do what he had been condemning for the last four chapters in Galatians? And he just got through telling them that if you do this, you're going to be lost, and then he's going to turn around and do it himself? That's a little bit self-contradictory there. Go ahead, C.L. Yeah, that's where they get that.
And that's not where he became. He put himself in the same status. If it was a person of low status.
Exactly.
He became, if it was a king he was talking to, he basically put himself on that same level. He communicated. If he was talking to somebody who was uneducated, that's how he talked to them. If it's an educated person, that's how he talked.
Absolutely, and you did a good job of explaining that.
He didn't change his morals. He didn't do bad things just so he could get to a bad person.
Right.
But he didn't talk down to people.
He talked to people on their own level. If he was talking to a beggar in the street, then he didn't act like he was any better than that beggar in the street.
And there were times that
Right. And that's what he means by this. I became as they are. He became weak to the weak. He became like a Jew to the Jews. It does not say that he went out and sacrificed an animal or had himself circumcised or any of the other or observed Jewish holy days. Or that's not what he's saying here. But that's the way a lot of people in the religious world today take this.
That makes it easier for them to make their conscience clear.
Right. Yeah, I'm just like Paul. I became a sinner like they are. And that's, you're basically right. That's exactly what they're doing. Paul did not compromise his values. If he had have compromised his values, then he would have been contradicting himself. Because he just got done telling them in his last breath about being worried about them observing these things in vain. So, anyway, he goes on to say, "Ye did me no wrong." Now, we need to keep in mind here that Paul had been using some very strong language in this letter. I mean, if you remember, he called them foolish. Paul's tearing them up. He's laying it out there on the line in this letter. He's using some real strong wording in the case that he's making against the law of Moses. He's basically told them two or three times now that they're lost. And he's really going to tell them in verse 5. He had just telling them, he just finished telling them that he was afraid that they had become Christians for nothing. One does not lightly use such language with no expectations of a negative response. You just don't walk up to somebody and tell them that their Christianity is vain and worthless and expect them to receive that message with great joy and thanksgiving. Paul had just told them that he was concerned that their religion was for nothing, that their work had been in vain. He just got done telling them that. He wants his readership to understand that he is not saying these things out of anger or in retribution because of anything hurtful that they may have done to him. He is assuring them that his motives with these strong words are of genuine concern for their well-being, and he wants them to understand that. Which leads right into verse 13. But ye know, this is just another breath in the same sentence. But ye know that because of an infirmity of the flesh, I preached the gospel unto you the first time. Not only does Paul want them to understand that he was not writing out of personal anger, that he was not pronouncing this condemnation upon them because of some prior treatment, and he's holding a grudge over it, he gives them an example of a great kindness that they had shown him previously. I'm not angry with you. He's just about to tell them, do I make myself your enemy because I tell you the truth? That one's coming up real quick. He's trying to get them to understand that the strong language that he has used was not because that they had done something wrong to him. That it's out of concern, out of his concern for their well-being. Paul had some kind of infirmity of the flesh, which was very obviously visible and of such a nature that it could even be a cause for rejection by some people. Yet they chose to overlook it with Paul and accept him and his teachings wholeheartedly. Paul is telling them that not only had they accepted him, they accepted him with his handicap and did not hold it against him. His motive for bringing this up is to demonstrate to his readership that he was not writing to them out of anger for past poor treatment, and he wants them to understand that he knows that and that he wants them to know that. That he realizes how much kindness that they had shown him, that he remembers that, how they had accepted him. Moving into verse 14, same sentence. We're all in the same, it's all in the same sentence that Paul is saying all this. So which verse 14 reads, "And that which was a temptation to you in my flesh, you despised not, nor rejected, but ye received me as an angel of God, even as Christ Jesus." Paul's physical infirmity was such that it would compel many to despise and or reject him outright. There have been many speculations as to exactly what this handicap was, and the Bible never comes out and specifically tells us what it is. But there are a number of clues, which has led many to the conclusion that Paul's eyesight was just a little bit better than just outright blindness. And it was obviously some visual thing about that, if that's what it was. We don't know for sure. We know that Paul requested through prayer on three occasions to have it removed and was denied. 2 Corinthians 12:7 through 9 is the evidence for that. We know from Acts 19:11 through 12 that while Paul spent 2 years in Ephesus, many special miracles were worked by his hands. It is interesting to note that Paul never used his miraculous abilities for self-serving measures. His miracles of healing were such that his handicap, that his handkerchief, and this is in the account in Acts, that his handkerchief or napkin would be taken by someone to someone who was sick. A napkin or a handkerchief that he had touched. And yet his own handicap remained with him. They would take his handkerchief or his napkins to their loved ones and they would be healed. Amazing miracles that were performed at the hand of Paul. And yet Paul never used that ability to heal himself. And I think that's very significant in that those gifts of healing that the apostles had, Paul and all the rest of them, were never used for self-serving measures. Never. It was always for the purpose of promoting the gospel, for confirming the power of God and the validity of the gospel. And anyway, we'll stop right there and we'll pick up in Galatians 4:15 next week, Lord willing. Thank you all so much for your comments. Thank you for your attention, and thank you for letting me stand up here and speak.